Hello, and welcome to the seventh episode of Season 3 of the Dark Money Files, in which we shine a light into a murky world. I'm Ray Blake, and with me is my co-host, friend, and business partner, Graham Barrow. Hello, Graham.
Hello, Ray.
So, Graham, media celebrity.
Well, Ray, I really don't think 20 seconds or so on a BBC documentary qualifies me as a celebrity. Although, if I'm honest, I'm slightly astonished at the reach of even such a cameo appearance.
And for those of you who've no idea what we're talking about...
And I suspect that there are many.
Possibly. We should explain that you appeared on a BBC One News documentary called Panorama last Monday, the 28th of October, in a programme about laundering billions of dollars of drug money through buying and selling large quantities of bullion in the gold markets of Dubai.
Do you know, and I can't imagine what the attraction of that story was, Ray.
Well, let's talk about that in a minute, Graham. But first of all, do you want to explain how you got involved in the first place?
Okay. Well, I was first approached way back in June or July this year by the producer of the programme. He'd been given my name partly through my writing, but partly because of the reach of this podcast. Some of the issues we'd covered on the Dark Money Files, and which I'd also written about, were, as it turned out, pretty relevant to the story.
That wasn't entirely obvious from the broadcast version, though, Graham.
Well, no, and it's worth spending a minute or two going through the process of recording, editing and broadcasting any sort of news media, because it does highlight in microcosm some of the challenges that investigative reporters face.
OK, so where do you want to start?
Well, back in late July, I had my first meeting with Tim, the producer, and I also met Anna, who was one of the whistleblowers, at the same time.
And was that to talk about the subject matter of the programme?
No, not really. It was just a chance to get to know the people involved and more importantly, as they already had a decent idea of where they wanted to take the programme, to see whether I could add anything of value.
And they must have decided you could.
Well, yes, but I don't think it was instant.
Oh?
Well, the next contact wasn't until late August, by which time there'd been a slight change in the content, but they were still keen to include an interview with me.
And when did the interview actually happen?
Beginning of September, Ray.
Oh, blimey. Quite a while before the broadcast date, then.
Yeah, but a programme like this goes through really significant fact-checking and, frankly, scrutiny by the lawyers, so it takes a little time to get it ready for broadcast.
I've always been uncomfortable that we miss out that stage.
Yeah.
Anyway, where were you interviewed?
In the exotic location of the Holiday Inn overlooking Brentford Lock in West London.
Ooh.
And I've got to say, although it looks like I was interviewed late at night, it was actually the middle of the afternoon.
I guess the lighting was to create the right atmosphere for the programme.
Yeah, I think so.
How long did the recording take?
Well, we started around 1:30 in the afternoon and finished, as far as I remember, somewhere between 4:30 and 5:00.
And that's a long time for 20 seconds of footage, Graham.
Yeah, I think there are a number of reasons for that, Ray.
Okay, go on.
Well, I'm sure some of what I said was either fairly incomprehensible, and I've got to tell you, it's astonishing how having a camera pointing at you does rather scramble your brain.
I can imagine.
And some of it was discarded simply because certain elements of the story, for all sorts of reasons, were ultimately not included in the programme. Partly simply because it was just a complex story which needed to be told in a short space of time, which meant everything had to be edited down to its absolute minimum.
It was quite a story, though.
It was, although in some respects it tends to reinforce an image of money laundering which isn't entirely helpful.
Now, I agree with that.
So do you want to explain why we think that, Ray?
Yes. Well, we know from our work with banks that one of the hardest things to overcome is the conflation of getting cash into the system by nefarious means and money laundering as a complete process.
Yeah, so that too often people see the cash element as the money laundering.
Yes, and that presents a whole variety of challenges. Not least that a huge percentage of money laundered through the system is never really held as cash in the first place.
So go on, give me some examples, Ray.
Well, let's start off with grand corruption.
OK, before we get into that, do you want to start by just defining what we mean by grand corruption?
Well, in a way, it's the exact opposite of petty corruption. It's corruption at the highest levels of government that requires subversion of the political, economic and legal processes and controls that should be in place to protect public funds, often raised from taxpayer revenue, and to protect that from being appropriated and used for personal gain.
OK, well, that's pretty clear.
And if you think about it, placement of cash into the system isn't required to launder corrupt funds at the national level, because they're already in the financial system when they're illegally appropriated.
Exactly. Anything else?
Well, think about tax evasion as well, Graham. Moving money through the system to evade tax and then reintroduce it as clean funds is still money laundering, but the money doesn't become criminal until the point at which the tax is evaded. And once again, it's highly likely to be already in the system when that happens.
So for a huge number of our listeners, their involvement in money laundering schemes is much more likely to be at what are traditionally known as the layering or the integration stages.
Yes, I like to think of this as the distancing process, both physically and metaphorically.
OK, I think you need to elaborate.
Well, that's so often the case, Graham. Let's go back to our grand corruption example, though. The one thing a corrupt public official is unlikely to do is leave their ill-gotten gains within the financial system of their home country. The likelihood is that the political, legal and regulatory system that allowed them to be corrupt in the first place also militates against leaving the funds for someone else to help themselves to.
Yeah, so they move them out.
Well, exactly, to somewhere which is the polar opposite of their own system.
Do you know, Ray, it is weird how much irony is baked into that statement and this process.
Well, yeah, I suppose it is, really. But the net result of all this is that they will want to distance the money, both geographically from its source, but also by disguising its origins so that it can't easily be traced back to its corrupt genesis.
So we can redefine, in a way, the layering and integration process as distancing and reintroduction.
Yes. I mean, if firms do want to keep their traditional model of money laundering, it's really important to redefine placement to be the point at which the laundering process starts and not just the introduction of cash into the system.
Yeah, and I know that there's a number of new models that are being proposed, all of which come at the problem in light of the new realities we face, but we'd characterise a more helpful description, I think, as initiate, distance, anonymise, wouldn't we?
We would, and you know that the whole placement, layering, and integration thing goes back further than the FATF, and as we saw a couple of weeks ago, the FATF was created to cut off the flow of funds from drugs dealers.
Yeah, absolutely.
So it's come a long way since then, but our understanding, or the popular understanding of money laundering, maybe hasn't evolved to the same degree. But anyway, be that as it may, I think there was another aspect of the programme that wasn't entirely helpful to the community, Graham.
What's that then, Ray?
Well, the two whistleblowers didn't exactly emerge from the situation too happily, did they?
No, they didn't. And at the risk of introducing spoilers into the podcast, I will agree with you.
And actually, we rely on whistleblowers feeling they'll be protected when they raise concerns. In the UK and in most countries, there are laws designed to make sure they can't face retribution for making a disclosure in good faith.
You're right, Ray. Generally, the protections work very effectively, and perhaps part of what makes this case newsworthy at all is the fate of the whistleblowers.
Yes, and that did come across in the programme. Hopefully what will also come across is the atypical nature of those outcomes for them.
Indeed, and that brings us back to the Panorama programme, which, by the way, is available to viewers in the UK or those with access to a VPN which uses a UK-based server via the BBC's iPlayer app. The episode is called, quote, Following the Drug Money. It represents a great story, but not necessarily one of the main conduits for the hundreds of billions of dollars laundered each year through the financial system.
And I think, in a spoiler-free way, we ought perhaps to offer a summary of the key lessons worth taking from the story.
Good idea, Ray. Where shall we start?
Let's talk about the cash and the gold, Graham.
Okay, well, for me, this was a classic demonstration that cash doesn't travel well. It doesn't like crossing more national borders than it has to, but will do so if it has to.
Yep, it's bulky. Gold is less bulky. It's not too volatile either, which means it's a good alternative to conventional currency transfer, where you'd always leave a paper trail.
Yeah, that's right, Ray, because you can buy and sell gold in any currency. Buy the gold in one currency, transport it, and then sell it in a different currency, and you've got a good chance of obscuring the trail.
I suppose the other point is that gold takes things outside of the conventional banking system, where systems may be circumvented more easily.
Yeah, it's complex and it requires a lot of time, effort and attention to detail, so much so that the layman wouldn't imagine criminals would or could go to such lengths. But many crimes are just so profitable that you can spend a fortune on your money laundering and still have a fortune left over to keep. And anyway, it is better to spend a lot making the rest safe than not spend enough and lose everything.
You're sounding like a money launderer yourself, Graham.
Well, you know, Ray, that is a risk. You have to think like one to catch one. But what else are the takeaways?
I think there's something about the systems to detect and prevent money laundering being fragile, Graham.
Yeah, I think that comes across.
And there's the importance of whistleblowing and the other checks and balances that bolster the system.
Of which journalists are one, really.
Yes, if you never hear or read of the system failing, it might mean that the system doesn't fail. But it's more likely to mean that there are problems getting insight into the system's fallibility. And giving these failures exposure is part of fixing the system so that they can't happen the same way again.
Yeah, they packed a fair bit into 30 minutes.
Exactly. And I hear it's not the last time we're going to see you on TV screens this year.
No, I think there will be at least one or two more programmes in which I will feature, but that is all I can tell you at the moment.
Well, that's amazing, and I'm sure we'll hear more.
Ray, do you know, I think that is in large part down to this podcast. As you know, one of our driving motivations is to elevate what the large number of hardworking, highly professional people who work in AML and financial crime compliance and beyond do, and make sure that that work gets the attention it deserves.
Agreed. One of the things we're very clear about is that if we can become one of the voices that helps to gain the proper recognition for those hardworking people who all too often find themselves on the front page for the wrong reasons, then that's got to be a good thing.
Yeah, and on that note, Ray, we've got a few more things happening in the world of the Dark Money Files, haven't we?
We have, Graham.
For example, I know you've completed the initial page and done it beautifully, if I may say, introducing the Dark Money Files YouTube channel.
Yes, I have. I've done that. It went live on Friday. And if you search YouTube for The Dark Money Files, you should find it pretty easily. And if you go there, have a look, like the sound of it, why not subscribe?
Which would mean the benefit of doing that, you'd get an alert every time we put new content on there.
Exactly.
And our website at thedarkmoneyfiles.com has had a significant level of input over the last few days as my son George, who's now working for us, has taken over duties for looking after it.
He is the new webmaster.
He is.
And you'll find lots of content there. You can download the podcasts, of course. But what you can do now is also search for a particular episode with content you recall and want later to review. And there wasn't an easy way to do that previously.
Yes, and you can also use the site to contact us, find out more about our training courses and other in-house activities that we offer just by going to thedarkmoneyfiles.com.
That's true.
And we've just started a brand new project which will run alongside the podcast, haven't we, Ray?
Yes, we have. It's early days yet, but there are a few exceptionally interesting but very complex investigations we've embarked on that are just too detailed to cover in one episode of the podcast or at a live event or even as a one-off YouTube video. So we're going to do a serial type podcast where, over a number of episodes, we take the listener through one of those extraordinary stories that starts out in the most innocent of environments and ends up linked to a huge variety of allegedly criminal operations in some more far-flung locations.
And I think we're also going to add video elements for those who would rather watch on YouTube than listen to a podcast.
Or for those who like to do both.
Exactly. We are currently writing the first season, provisionally titled The Tower, with a view to launching it early in the new year.
So stay tuned for updates. Such a shame that The Dark Tower was already taken, by the way.
Yeah, although hopefully it won't take quite as long to write as that particular series, Ray. Now, what have we got coming up in the next week or so?
I can't help thinking, with a general election in the offing in the UK and the next round of presidential elections starting to gear up in the US, one of the things it will bring into sharp focus is the issue of politically exposed persons, or PEPs.
Oh, yes. Some people, let's be honest, will cease to be PEPs.
Or not, depending on the financial institution that we're talking about and their individual policy.
Well, exactly. And, of course, others will become PEPs.
Yes, that's probably a more straightforward decision for UK and US national politicians, but less so for regional or local elections.
And that's a good point. And of course, with all those new PEPs will come the need to perform enhanced due diligence, source of wealth and all of that stuff.
And we know how problematic that can be for firms, don't we?
Yes, we do.
So maybe it's time to do a sequence of episodes on PEPs and other high-risk clients. Maybe look at other risk factors.
Well, yeah, we were going to do, I remember, an episode on country risk anyway, weren't we?
We were.
So let's do a mini-series on risk, kicking off next week with an introduction to the world of PEPs.
I'm looking forward to it.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Dark Money Files. We hope you enjoyed it. If you would like to listen to future episodes, please subscribe through iTunes, Spotify, or your normal podcast provider. Thanks.